All right, everybody, welcome back into Mining Stock Daily. We're going to get some general macro commentary today and definitely hopefully talk about the commodities complex a bit, including precious metals. But last week when we were reporting from Zurich and the European Gold Forum, there's a number of macro events that took place. Not only did the CPI numbers come in hotter than anticipated, but also there was a 10-year auction that just was quite awful, actually. And our guest here today, Barry Knapp from Ironside Macroeconomics, is joining us. He called last week a macro regime change, and so we're going to talk about that. Barry, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Yeah. Tell me, talk about the significance of what we saw last week and what you were seeing.
The we had a view, or I'd say Fed policy officials had a view, that perhaps the strong and hot inflation data we got in January and February was an aberration, screwy seasonal adjustment factors related to the pandemic. I actually thought the case for the labor market data being overstated was stronger than the case for inflation data being overstated or biased to the hotter, strong side. This was always about the point in time when the underlying inflation trend was going to emerge. And the reason I say that is, if you look at the various components of inflation as laid out by Chairman Powell in a Brookings speech he gave back in November 22, which is core goods prices, non-housing services, some people call it super core, and then housing, you had rolling peaks in each of those various measures. Goods prices peaked all the way back in February of 22. Super core services peaked in September of 23, or September of 22, excuse me. And then housing didn't actually peak until February of last year, 23, that is. So once you got past the February 24 inflation number, you were going to start to see what the underlying trend looks like. And it's pretty clear that inflation looks unlikely to go back down to the Fed's target. And I would ascribe the major factor in driving that as the most expansive non-recessionary fiscal policy we've ever had. So there was a lot of people trying to pick apart the numbers last week and say, well, you know, auto insurance was up, healthcare is coming back, and you know, maybe that's only temporary. The reality is inflation is a broad process, right? And fiscal policy deficits running at 7% of GDP raises the aggregate level of demand. So to be sure, there's differences between core goods prices, which are getting hit with something of a deflationary shock from China. But that shock is actually fading. And so goods prices are coming up. A year ago, people were talking about inflation less shelter. And it was a legitimate way to frame the inflation outlook a year ago, because goods prices were going down. Super core services was running at 0.2% per month. It's now at 0.42% per month. So it's actually reaccelerated. Energy prices were cooling. Food prices were cooling. Now all those measures are headed higher. And housing inflation, which was supposed to cool as rents eased some 2 years ago, has not cooled at all and is running at 0.45%, well above the pre-pandemic trend of something like 0.25%. So long-winded way of saying the inflationary trend is looking like, and this is what we thought from the very early days of the pandemic, that we were not going back to 2% inflation. Pandemic policies and fiscal policy in particular has created an environment very much like the 60s, where sure, we could have faster nominal growth, and there's asset classes that can do reasonably well in that, including equities in aggregate, but in particular, sectors like energy, materials, industrials, tech will do just fine, but small caps, banks, and any rate sensitive sectors are going to struggle mightily. But the bond market is going to struggle. And that, to me, is when I talked about regime change, a lot of people, including my friend Ann Ives, you know, the notable tech analyst, has equated this tech cycle to being more like 95 you know, than 98 or 99. And I agree with that from a tech perspective, but the broad macro regime is more similar to the 60s than the 90s, both of which were very strong capital spending cycles, strong nominal growth, reasonably good for the equity market. But one was a inflationary or reflationary regime with negative bond returns, and the other was a period of disinflation in the decade of a, you know, four decade bond bull market. So
the 90s being the disinflation period, the 60s being the inflationary period. Okay, just want to make sure we were clarifying that for the listeners. Yeah. So it was interesting. I mean, listen, you could maybe watch half a dozen charts here the last two or three months here, Barry. If you're going to see what inflation was going to do, this, the hotter CPI print absolutely did not shock me. I watch food prices, you know, watch agriculture prices, obviously the metals prices, transportation prices. I mean, they're all just raging through the month of March into April. And here we are. And I'm almost curious if the next CPI print, you know, what those expectations are going to be, because I don't see anything cooling off. Like, I almost think it could be hotter than what we saw for March.
From a headline perspective, that's entirely true. And it sort of brings me back to last year's outlook, which was that we were going to have disinflation for the first half of the year as we lapped some of those really strong, you know, pandemic shock peaks. But then the headline number was likely to trough in June as it lapped the Russian invasion energy price and food price peak. And then that would level off and we'd have some downward pressure in the core because of housing. But when you look at it, as you point out today, you've got all of those measures going back the other way. Energy going up, food going up. Those are, you know, 7% and 14% of the CPI basket. But then, you know, non-housing services, the Fed, and this is a little subtle but important, the Fed has made the point that, well, we've gotten a big increase in the supply of labor. So that's keeping wage growth from, you know, pushing too high and creating a wage price spiral. Not exactly. Okay. We've got a surge in immigration. That's putting pressure on the lowest quartile of wages. And you could see the Atlanta Fed wage tracker has a, you know, they give you the lowest, all the quartiles. So I look at the lowest versus the highest. During the pandemic, that spread of the lowest over the highest was the highest it had been in the history of the series, going back to the late 90s. That's collapsed to zero. So immigration is putting pressure on the lowest quintile or quartile of wages, but not the middle quartiles or the upper quartile. So that's where the pressure is building. And that's where the Fed is likely getting the story somewhat wrong. But in reality, the Fed has no control over this, right? If you think about what the Fed's done, if you are a borrower who borrows floating rate debt from the front end of the market, financial conditions are tight. So that's true of small businesses, real estate developers, small banks that live on being able to get cheap deposits and lending them out at higher rates. This is the, you know, the third deepest yield curve inversion in U.S. history, only surpassed by DSIB 79 and DSIB 80, even deeper than the inversion in October of 73. So their conditions are tight. But because of the way they did passive QT and aggressive rate hikes, the back end of the bond market, if you fund there like a large financial group, conditions aren't all that tight. Term premiums are negative. Those rates are below where they probably should be given the overall growth and inflation outlook. And certainly if you're a beneficiary of fiscal policy, like you're getting semiconductor, you know, investment money or the Infrastructure Act or all the extra ARPA money that's still around that's driving state and local government hiring, which is rising at a almost 3% annualized rate, with the private sector only growing at a 1.6% annual rate. Conditions are really loose, right? So, you know, you've got this broad fiscal impulse. You've got recovery in energy prices, food prices, core goods prices, because China's coming out of, you know, their pandemic induced recession, if you want to call it that. Probably was, actually, if we had real GDP numbers, probably was a recession, but all that demand's picking back up. So, you know, thinking that inflation is on a path, even a albeit a bumpy one, to two doesn't make that much sense. Now, listen, stable inflation running 3 to 3.5% is not a problem for a lot of the equity market and a lot of asset classes, including, you know, energy and materials. But it's surely a problem for small banks and small business.
Yeah. Barry, back in December, after the FOMC, we were talking a Fed policy pivot. That's up for debate now. In fact, I would say almost there's like a bond market pivot. From the beginning of the year, the market was expecting 6 rate cuts compared to the Fed's 3. Now we are, I couldn't even tell you where we're at now, but I know the market's not at 6. It's definitely probably like maybe 2, 3 at the most. But just talk about this like back and forth. It seems like a complete flip between market and Fed expectations. And with this data, it's hard to argue that the Federal Reserve just does not have the data to support any cuts right now. And the market is still kind of still a little bit still drinking the Kool-Aid from the frat party the night before to try to finish it off until it's gone. So how does this narrative, how are these two expectations, how are they battling right now as we talk?
Well, let's call it 1.5 cuts roughly that are priced today, but that's assuming something of a log normal distribution. And I think market participants are willing to put a fatter tail on the Fed getting forced to cut aggressively, right? And I keep talking about the small banks, small businesses, and the potential for something to break. Now, I do not believe Silicon Valley Bank was solely attributable to a bunch of knuckleheads running that place. Surely there were knuckleheads that were running that place. But the reason that their deposits went from $60 billion to $190 billion was the actions of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. So they get all of these deposits with nowhere to go. They buy treasuries, and then they just get smoked on their treasury portfolio. New York Community Bank is similar, except that they invested into even more illiquid assets. Consider buying rent-stabilized New York apartment buildings. If the policy rate is zero, that may not be a bad trade. I'm sure they bought them or made those loans, you know, at a pretty good level, essentially accumulating cheap assets that are fine in a zero policy rate environment. But we're not in a zero policy rate environment. Small banks hold something like 38% of their assets in real estate. Most of these assets were accumulated at a much lower rate environment. So in a lot of ways, when you think about the banking system, the right analog is not 2008. We're not waiting for a giant credit crunch here. Those assets will perform. They will generate cash flow. But this is like 1980, when Volcker deeply inverted the curve and basically drove the thrift industry out of business, which at the time was 80% of the supply of mortgage credit. Commercial banks weren't even in that business. They'd made mortgage loans throughout the course of the 70s. Then the policy rate goes to 20%. They actually had no ability. They were being disintermediated on two fronts. One was on the asset side from securitization and mortgage lending. And the other side was on the deposit side from money market funds. So even when the curve disinverted, they weren't able to raise the funds and earn their way out of the difficulties. There's a lot of similarities to small banks right now. Why would you go put your deposits in small banks? You may as well go to a fintech organization. Anybody who's got the $250,000, you know, deposit insurance, and you can easily move your money around and in and out with technology. So, you know, if you think about that environment and all those little banks sitting out there with these assets, they've made at bad prices. And bank profitability coming down, that was part of the story on Friday, was pressure on net interest income, because even JP Morgan eventually has to pay you something on your checking deposit. So that pressure on the banking system is part of that expectation that the Fed could get forced to cut aggressively later in the year. And so like I said, just thinking about linearly and thinking how could the Fed cut it all given the data, that's the way he could cut it, is if something goes wrong, right?
And yeah. I mean, Barry, there's a huge difference between a rate cut because you're forced to and a rate cut because you're able to. Huge 100%. Difference. Right. And I want to ask you, so there are a couple big, you know, big line items here. We've got, you know, obviously it's, the yields have been rising, so bonds have been selling off through across the board. Wednesday was a massive day after that CPI print. So we have yields rising. We have a dollar just relentlessly moving higher. In both of those scenarios, you would expect safe haven assets like precious metals to be falling below your computer screen, but they kept on moving higher. How, I mean, this is a very interesting situation here. In fact, I would say it's incredibly bullish for precious metals, but have you ever seen a situation like that where everything was moving tangentially together?
Yeah, I've done a lot of studying on the 60s, but I was born in 1962. So, you know, I wasn't staring at screens at the time. You know, but this is really indicative of that. And the points I made earlier about financial conditions being very different depending on how you finance is, I think, integral to what you're describing, because fiscal policy is incredibly accommodative. We haven't run 7% deficits or spending at 24 to 25% of GDP during an expansion ever. So that policy is super accommodative. The way the Fed conducted the easing process was primarily asset purchases. They cut rates by 150 basis points, but the amount of longer-term securities they bought was the equivalent, based on most of the studies, of something like 250 basis points of rate cuts. But when they turned around, they did 550, 525 basis points of hikes and are only very passively unwinding QE. And now what's important about QE, QT is the fixation of the Fed and most market participants is on the first channel of QE, which is liquidity and the creation of bank reserves. But the more important channels for risk markets is the effect on longer duration assets like 10-year real rates or TIPS, and volatility channel, which is the most underappreciated. When the Fed buys 30% of the mortgage market, that is the single biggest source of interest rate volatility, prepayment risk. Well, they squish it because all they simply do is reinvest mortgages that mature, pay down, into more mortgages. So when they were buying $40 billion a month in 2001, they were reinvesting $55 to $60 billion a month. So that's squashed volatility. You can see that in the MOVE index that averaged 100 pre-global financial crisis and less than 75 in the next decade. You know, as that starts to unwind, it will come back. But the Fed is still putting downward pressure on longer-term rates, longer-term volatility. So again, that's the stuff that, you know, like when we have a risk off that goes across asset classes and across markets, it generally comes from a shock in 10-year real rates. That was true in early 2018 and in the fourth quarter of 2018. That's moving up, but I would say until we get to 10% on 10-year TIPS, you'd still have to consider financial conditions relatively easy. I mean, we're at the same level now as we were at in the period before the global financial crisis, that 10-year TIPS yield averaged like 210 basis points. So we're not actually restrictive in a lot of ways. So to see, you know, commodity prices going up, precious metals prices going up, Bitcoin going up, you know, given how super loose fiscal policy is and the back end of that, you know, that whole duration vol channel, it kind of makes sense. And this is why I was so critical early on of the way the Fed was conducting the tightening process. They could have avoided this deep curve inversion if they'd done a combination of selling some mortgages outright and being more aggressive with unwinding their treasury, the longer term treasuries, as opposed to just this liquidity channel. And they just got that completely wrong.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's almost unfathomable to think about what you just said. I mean, that's just because given where we've been at with ZIRP for so long. You know, right. We haven't seen a cycle like this, at least in right. probably even my lifetime. I know I'm, you know, 20 years younger than you, Barry. Don't hate me for it, but you know, yeah. But if we have, I, you know, in my career, I haven't seen something like this. So that's a hard one to even fathom.
Right. Right. And so. Listen, you know, people will describe the, you know, the asset purchase QE dynamic as unprecedented, but in so many ways, it's this, what's happening now is identical to what happened in the 50s and 60s, because we had explicit interest rate caps from 1942 in World War II through 51. And the way they were, it was conducted with a cap, the banking system accumulated a vast pool of treasury securities on their balance sheet. Something like 70% of their assets at the end of World War II were in treasuries. It took 30 years to wind that down. So if you look at what happened to the bond market from the 50s all the way through the 70s, you just had a series of higher highs and higher lows as that financial repression got unwound. Mm. And we're back in the same environment. And I think this is what, you know, like you'll hear street interest rate strategists on CNBC saying, oh no, you got to buy treasuries here, you know, and they're going to 3%. The only way they're going to 3% is if something really bad goes wrong, like a serious recession, which is almost impossible to have when we run 7% budget deficits, right? So this is a reflationary regime. And that's what, you know, I try to say in the note this week, you know, macro regime change, you've got to get your head around the fact that this isn't the 90s, you know? It may be in terms of tech and technology and capital spending, but from a broad macro, reflation, bond market is a lot more like the 1960s.
Yeah. You know, last topic I want to hit, and we can touch about just generally, you did write in that same note, you wouldn't be surprised to see a pretty meaningful correction in the equity market. You know, 10%, I think, is what you wrote. I mean, that would be obviously meaningful, probably a buying opportunity at that. I mean, that would take the S&P, you know, to 4,500, give or take here where we're at today, Barry. And, you know, but do you think that 10% correction would be probably the trigger point for the Fed to be like, oh, there we go. Let's call markets, lower interest rates.
It would be if it happens the way I expect it to happen, but not so much just because of the equity market. It would be very similar to what happened. And in essence, we are getting a little bit of a redo, or we could very well get a little bit of a redo from what happened from August through October of last year. So remember that August move higher in rates, began with a Treasury announcement. And the Treasury announcement was, we have $500 billion more coupon securities for sale in the next two quarters than the market expected. And so the market started to move. And then the Fed had a very hawkish September summary of economic projections, and in essence forecasted keeping the policy rate above 5% for the next 15 months or so. And then, you know, you had another big move. Tens went to 5%. And it was really driven by Treasury supply initially, and then Fed policy exacerbating that and creating an environment where the banking system couldn't help support the Treasury issuance. Because you think about it today, next week is going to be belly week, right? The Treasury is going to issue twos, fives, and sevens. That's where they need the banking system to participate. The banking system can't be buying five-year Treasuries at 450 if they don't believe the curve's going to disinvert sometime in the next year or two, because those securities will carry positive. They're paying 5.5% for CDs, and they're going to invest them in 4.5% treasuries. It's a one-way ticket to FDIC resolution, right? So like Silicon Valley Bank. So this is kind of the issue that they're faced with. Now, what the Treasury and Fed did to stop the move in rates was Treasury issued above the 15 to 20% recommended amount of bills from the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee, the private sector bond traders who advise Treasury on what they ought to be doing. And they issued bills for two quarters. Now, the problem with all that issuing of bills is that's forcing the Fed to slow QT. So you see how this whole thing interplays here. But then they announced in late February, early March, they were going to issue an extra $519 billion of coupon securities. The market accepted that because they thought the Fed was going to start cutting. And again, that would facilitate banks absorbing a lot of the supply. Remember, Yellen's lost her three best customers. The best customer was the Fed. Second best customer were banks. And third best customer were Asian central banks trying to weaken their currencies. Well, now they're trying to strengthen their currencies, right? Yen at 154 and RMB at right. 7.25. And so they're not big buyers. And the banking system can only buy if they think the Fed's easing. So now we've got all this treasury supply to absorb, and we get another move to 5%. Well, that will put the Fed in a quandary where, you know, the Fed, Bill Martin, the chairman of the Fed back in the 50s and 60s used to say, the Fed is independent within, not of the government. Ultimately, they are agent of Treasury and Congress, and they will have to help facilitate the supply. So if financial conditions tighten a lot on the back end, and we start to see strains in the banking system, that would be a quandary for the Fed for sure. And they better hope the data is a little cooperative at that point, you know? So,
yeah, I think Secretary Yellen's trip to China, I think the reason behind that was written in the stars, although the headlines, as I read it, said that she was trying to convince them to manufacture more solar panels. I couldn't call more bullshit in my entire life, given what you just said there, Barry. All right. It's tax day, Barry. I'm sure you've got to scramble here to get everything paid off and pay the man here for the last minute. But but I appreciate your time. This is a lot of insight. You give us a lot of food for thought. And we're going to do it again in the next couple of weeks and see how this all plays out. Thanks again. Before I let you go, let us know where we can find your work.
Sure. Ironsidesmacro.substack.com. And in essence, what I've been producing on there is institutional quality street research. I was Barclays head of equity strategy. I was director of fundamental fixed income research. I worked at Lehman and Barclays for 25 years in derivatives, principal trading, and then in research. And I love doing it on my own. So, you know, the work is broad. The notes are 2,500 to 3,000 words coming out every Saturday morning with a bunch of charts and tables. And it went through, you know, the economic outlook, the policy outlook, both fiscal and monetary, and then what it means from the perspective of an investor, because I've been an investor. I traded Lehman's money. I helped run money for BlackRock. And so it's always with that lens to what do you do with all this? And so as bearish as I might have sounded, I'm still making the point that, you know, equities just did just fine in the 60s. We had faster nominal growth, stronger earnings growth. You had to be in the right sectors and right places, but equities can survive in that environment. Sure, when you get into rapid, you know, runaway inflation, then all asset classes, you know, are going to struggle. But in a reflationary regime, there's plenty of stuff to do for sure, including, you know, as I've been saying, be in energy, be in industrials, be in materials, you know, tech, but avoid small banks, small caps, any rate sensitive stuff. Be in the front end of the bond market, no longer than twos. And you know, don't get yourself caught up in the street. Yeah, we're going back to 3% on tens, because the only way that happens is if things go, you know, really pear-shaped.
Yeah. And if you inquire about a subscription to Ironside, tell Barry that Mining Stock Daily sent you. All right, Barry, thanks so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
All right, Trevor.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Mining Stock Daily and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.